I'm Jeremy Halladina at UC Santa Barbara, and we've the pleasure of talking in studio today with Clarence Barlow, who is the new Corwin Professor of Composition here, which means that he essentially holds the reins of UCSB's music composition program. Welcome, Clarence.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And you were born, of course, in Calcutta, but you've been a great many places, which leads me to wonder if you have multiple allegiances, creatively speaking. How would you detail that for us?
Well, the interesting thing is, of course, I've been many places, but so were my ancestors, and that's why they landed in Calcutta, because they came from England, Portugal, France, North India, South India, Burma, and all converged on Calcutta with the various genes. And I was born there and brought up in an English Catholic environment. So when I came to Europe at the age of 22, it was like a homecoming in many respects, because unfortunately I never learned to speak any Indian language reasonably. But I learned to love Indian music, so that's something that came upon me just before I left. But as a child, I was playing the piano, playing Beethoven sonatas, and began to compose as a young man of about 11. And so I came to Europe for the simple reason of brushing up and carrying on what I'd started already in Calcutta.
But you're no stranger, evidently, to America, because you've been able to step into this position with complete ease, or at least so it seems to us.
Well, on the one hand, the English culture that I've brought with me. On the other hand, the fact that American culture is ubiquitous, is omnipresent all over in the world. My parents and I used to go, and my brother, used to go to the cinema every weekend, and of course we saw American movies. So that's no big shock. I mean, it's really something you know. Except, of course, things you're not exposed to outside of America are the bureaucracy.
Well, we do have our share of that here too, Clarence.
That's what I mean. That's the bureaucracy I wasn't prepared for.
Well, it's amazing, considering the French supposedly are the founders of bureaucracy, it's maybe a bit terrifying to hear that we've gotten so far in so short a time. I'd like to do something here, because I know that you love the automated piano, and you've written extensively already for this instrument. And I'd like to hypothetically put you on the artist's bench of this automated instrument, and there you begin to play a movement from Beethoven, and almost indiscernibly strange things begin to happen around you, which are evidently beyond your control. What are your feelings as this is happening, as it does in one of your most celebrated works? What are your feelings both as player and as composer?
As player, of course, I've made it easy for myself, because I just have to play the Beethoven theme of the arietta, the last movement of Beethoven's last sonata. But as a composer, the idea was initially much more complex. I actually had envisaged a real concert pianist sitting at that piano and interacting with this increasing amount of music which was coming out of the piano itself, thinking about how to avoid the pianist hitting a note which was already down, for example. But as time grew short, and also as I got closer to the deadline in another respect, in other words, I was already in the midst of composition, of composing the piece, I began to realize that this simple solution was probably the most elegant and the best. And therefore I came up with it, and it also, of course, related me as the pianist to Beethoven's work, which I'd always loved.
And this work is Variations and a Mechanical Piano, correct?
Correct.
Or in Italian, Variazioni e un Piano Meccanico.
Pianoforte Meccanico.
Yes.
Exactly.
So that still leads me to wonder, though, about the relationship between the stage character who is sitting there as the pianist of the moment, shall we say, who's all of a sudden experiencing this proliferation of pitch. As composer, you may have chosen that particular movement because it's known as one of Beethoven's most mathematical, actually, in terms of how the variations proceed, and perhaps for another reason, that it was the last statement of Beethoven, therefore what comes after. But how is the stage character to be interpreted, the character that the audience sees there at the moment that this eruption of notes takes place?
I've portrayed that character in a number of ways. One of them, a pianist or a piano player at home. We had an upright and I had a sofa and a lamp installed next to the piano. So that gives you a very homely feeling. But of course, it's also I've also portrayed the concert pianist coming on stage and bowing to the audience and sitting down and purporting to play that theme. Mm-hmm. That's a strange thing to start with the second movement. I've also done other things. I've also started to play other Beethoven sonatas and pretended not to be satisfied and to move on and finally settle down on that particular movement. Ah. And then at that point, the piano comes alive and begins to do all these things. Now, I've never written instructions for performance because I've been up to now almost the only one to play that piece. But recently, I had to coach a Finnish lady in Helsinki, and I told her what to do, and I said, you have to now be a little surprised at the beginning, slightly, uncertain of what's happening. And then very gradually, you begin to enjoy it, and you settle down to playing with the piano until the piano becomes so overwhelming that you have to go away, but you don't go completely away because you're not giving up on this. You're interested, you're fascinated. So you sit down not far from the piano, maybe out of the light, and you keep your gaze fixed on the piano until at the very end a tremolo freezes the piano's ability to carry on. Mm-hmm. And then the pianist comes back and reminds the piano where both had started. So that's the dramaturgy, if you like, and that's something I may have to write down one day if somebody else is to play.
But that's very significant in a way that the live person has to come back to help the machine, as it were, out of the dilemma to which it eventually arrives.
Right. The piano seems rather helpless at that point, having already traversed an enormous distance, a tremendous journey of styles even, and the piano is kind of practically exhausted, mm-hmm. and so the pianist has to come back.
It's one of the things I admire most in your output, that this meeting of man and technology is on such friendly terms, generally, that we don't feel any animosity or tension. Only surprises and delightful things seem to come of it. But I did want to go further with this, a little bit further anyway, and ask you, what is the mechanical piano a symbol of in your work? Because there are more than one work. There's more than one.
I may actually start with why I started to use the mechanical piano. And that was simply because I have written very difficult music, unfortunately. It's not that I choose to do so, but it's sometimes very, very difficult. And pianists have always managed it, just about. But I've always wanted to hear a rendition of this music that I've composed in an accurate fashion. So sometime in the late 70s, when I wrote a big piano piece lasting half an hour for solo piano, which has been played by a pianist, I wanted to hear it before I could even give it to any pianist because all I had in front of me was numbers crunched out by a computer. So I wrote a program to emulate a piano sound, first recording my own piano and inputting that into the computer. So that took me months, and finally I got a tape which encouraged the pianist who played it later to play it because he heard the music. I couldn't have possibly written the score even at that point because when I did that, it was only after the pianist had agreed to play the piece, and it took me 1 year to write the score because there was such a lot to put down on paper. The realization of very difficult pieces was therefore my interest, and I used electronic means at the beginning. But when the player piano became available in the mid-80s to me, I realized that the sound would be so much better that I would much, much prefer, and MIDI was also brought in. MIDI, mm-hmm. that's the system of linking computers with synthesizers, was introduced in the early 80s, in 84. And that's where I pounced on that and went away from sound wave generation to MIDI, which is not perfect by any means, we know that, but it's always helped me. And the player piano with its wonderful sound, that of a real piano in other words, and MIDI, which is much simpler, have been my mainstay since then.
But it's been necessary, I think, for you to go a little bit beyond that even in writing new software, and you're a pioneer in that area as well, new software that allows some of your difficult rhythmic concepts, especially those that overlay difficult rhythms, one atop the other, those were not approachable in the old MIDI, but you've managed to solve that problem to some degree.
Well, the rhythmic problems, you can, with MIDI, you have a resolution of 1/600th of a second, officially, actually about 1/200th of a second if you're approaching an instrument outside the computer. So that is fine enough, I think, rhythmically. You can get all kinds of polyrhythms accommodated in that. The big problem is, of course, notating such rhythms, and that's another issue altogether. Mm-hmm. I've written a program that can notate practically any unplayable rhythm into readable form.
So you're suggesting that it was really the rather antiquated notation system that we inherited from Beethoven, really, as concerns simple divisions.
Yes.
And the meters that accommodate those simple divisions.
Yes, because a very important issue is practically all of the pieces that you know of mine for player piano are actually intended for real pianists. It was only Variazioni, which was really a player piano piece. Maybe one other, Otto de Blue, but even that piece, and one other, Estudio Siete for film, a film by Oscar Fischinger, that was a soundtrack, was a player piano. That music would be probably unplayable and would remain so. But practically everything else that I've written for player piano has actually not been written for player piano at all, but I present it in both forms, live and on the player piano.
And there are interpretations in both forms too, correct? There are
yes.
live performances and then automated live performances, I guess one would say.
Yeah. Yes, because when I generate a live player piano version, then I try to make sure that it really has all the qualities that I want. Mm-hmm. So I may have to edit it a little bit. But this is why I have to notate everything as well mm-hmm. for the pianist or the other instrumentalists, sometimes string players and so on.
Let's move to a different area, which is the fact that you love to turn sound into visual items and visual items into sound. You have characterized your art as, to some degree, synesthetic, and I wonder whether you are synesthetic. Have you always been that from birth, that when you see a picture, you might hear a sound, or when you hear a given pitch, you might see a color or something like that?
Well, certainly when I heard pitches, I always saw colors. For example, the 12 notes of the octave, mm-hmm. I could name a few. C was always white, okay, one might say, all right. But then F was always green, A was yellow, D was royal red, and for what reason I don't know, but there it was, and I felt that. E flat was a wonderful blue color. So I began to see all of that, and I remember in the mid-70s I actually tried to depict one of my pieces using colors, and knowing that looking at the chart, looking at the diagram I would generate, one could actually sense what kind of music that would be. It took me about 30 years to do that finally, because of computer technology, but I managed that in the early years of this century.
I know that the few students in my classes who claim to have this ability of synesthesia, they're always fiercely arguing about what color a given note is.
Oh, yes.
And did you find that your colors, for example, matched anyone else's?
No, not at all. If you look mm-hmm. at the colors that Brahms saw and Scriabin, mm-hmm. totally different to each other and different to me. And I'm pretty sure that that's an entirely inborn thing that just comes out of one. Words also have color for me. Words and even single letters, single digits have color.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Even? Wow. So how early in your output were you attempting to cross the bridge between these two realms? Can you pinpoint it?
I think it must have been in the mid-70s. I'm not quite sure in which direction I went first. I probably went from music to the visuals, but then much later I began to see in images a source of music, not simply scanning them from left to right, but finding certain salient points and making them into musical issues.
Because there were works prior to this, correct me if I'm wrong, which didn't attempt to cross the gap. That is, there were works that had both a visual dimension and an auditory one, but they rather stood apart from one another without trying to cross into one another.
Well, in, I think, 72 or 73, certainly not later than that, I had plans for a film which would be a motet, I said, and the frames of the film would be similar to the sounds you would hear, and there would be four voices, two visual and two auditory.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of those cases you're talking about.
What inspired you to go in this direction? Did any forebears like Scriabin or anything like that?
I don't think so. I've always mm-hmm. been very visually oriented for some reason, even though I'm a musician.
And your wife is a prominent sculptor.
Sculptress. Yes, exactly. Yes. So, but of course, we met only 23 years ago, and that started all this much longer, much
right.
earlier.
For me, the big question that I have to pose you is, how do you decide in a given instance whether you will attempt to send picture into sound or sound into picture, or whether you'll, as it were, leave well enough alone and not attempt them to bridge into one another? Are there cases where you wouldn't make that attempt?
I'm pretty sure. For example, I've always, ever since I composed Variazioni, the piece we spoke about, mm-hmm. I've had a desire to make a film to that music. But that film would not be derived at all from the notes of the piece. It would be a theatrical film. It would start with the pianist and very gradually even leave the concert hall, and during long passages towards the end of the piece, probably in flight above the Arctic regions of the planet. So, and come back, of course, at the end to the hall where the pianist is sitting. So that film would certainly be totally different. It would be only accompanied by the music, or the music accompanied by the film. But what you're talking about is, for example, when asked to write a piece for a pianist who turned 50, Christy Becker, who has performed a lot of my music wonderfully, I, for some reason, thought of her face and thought of using that face to generate the score, mm-hmm. which I did. But when I was asked for another pianist, Deborah Richards, and she turned 50, and I wrote a piece for her, she's also played my music wonderfully. So in her case, I took her name, D-E-B, being, for example, a source for notes and a source for rhythms through mathematical manipulations of those three letters.
So I'll rephrase the question then. Under what circumstances do you feel absolutely impelled to try to turn a picture of a pianist into sound? And when would you say, well, not this time?
I wouldn't know.
I think that's what I find so fascinating is when you decide to do it. But well, you've done it with remarkable success. And we could talk also about the Fischinger score that you mentioned, the Estudio Siete, because there's an intermediary device, is there not? That is, you take, well, we should probably begin by crediting this great emigre filmmaker, Oscar Fischinger, who's well known to people in Southern California. And many have tried, actually, to do scores for these abstract animated films. But yours, help me with this, but I believe it takes vowel formants. It takes what Fischinger has on the screen in the way of abstract shapes, converts those to vowel formants, and then there's a second conversion, or how would you put it?
Well, I regard those objects flying around on the screen as objects which are either elongated horizontally or roundish. I've not seen objects which are exactly, mm-hmm. so more like this. And if they are round, then I wanted to give the music a kind of ooh quality. And if they are elongated, more an E quality is when we stretch our lips in order to say E.
It's a perfect fit. So how soon did it take before you realized that the vowel was the solution to the fat or thin shapes that Fischinger had provided? Was that a long road to discovery?
I'm not sure anymore. It's about been 12 years now. I could imagine the following. I was talking to a friend who studied at the University of Zurich, and I told him that I'd like to extract information from each frame of this movie to make the music. I didn't know how exactly. So he said for that we would have to track each object down. So he took it to Zurich with him, and a program there called the Automatic Blob Recognition Program by Martin Bixler recognized every single frame, recognized all the objects in each frame, and I was sent overnight, because I was in a hurry, a file containing information on every frame, indeed, every object. So a list of every object, its position in X and Y coordinates, and its width and height. I could imagine looking at these images that I thought, oh, look at the way they stretch and they become round again, and that might have brought in, because you know I like to work with linguistic matters, mm-hmm. with language. Mm-hmm. So it could have been that I thought at that point, don't they look like mouths? Don't they look like sounds of speech? And then decided to do that from there on.
Well, it works. It's beautiful. Which do you think is, in fact, more expressive, or could you say which, the pixel or the note?
Ah. Well, the note contains much more information than the pixel. And even one tone played on the piano can be very evocative, whereas the pixel itself doesn't exist.
I'm happy, Clarence, that you made the musical choice. But does that mean that in a compensatory way, then, that when you convert to picture, you have to try harder or put more in some sense, to compensate for the lost emotional baggage of the note?
If I convert something to a picture, it is rarely with the shall we say, demand or the ambition to make a work of art, a visual work of art. It's the other way around. When I actually convert images to sound, to music, I'm very particular about the aesthetic quality of the heard, of the oral. But in the other way, it's actually more maybe for pedagogical reasons to analyze my pieces in a lecture and to show very carefully and clearly how the piece was constructed. So converting to an image is not that I do it in a haphazard, kind of sloppy sort of way, but I do it with less pretensions to art mm-hmm. than the other way around.
And there is another piece that converts, which goes right back to this color question, and you availed yourself of some prominent Swiss artists who were known for their color work. This work treated red, green, and blue, did it not? Could you tell us about that one?
Yes, I was sitting in one of their performances, and they were recounting the names of all kinds of colors in German. And, well, like vermilion, scarlet, crimson, and so on and so on, and then into the blue region and so on. And I was inspired by that. I could even see these colors while they were saying the words, obviously. Even though, for me, words have color, a word like blue might not look blue. In that case, it does. But certain words have a different color to the color they stand for. But be that as it may, I began to actually see colors circulating in space. And that brought me to the idea of taking a picture on a screen and running a mouse through it, and every pixel that I would touch, the colors, red, green, and blue in there, would trigger a certain proportion, a certain amount of a sound file stored in the memory of the computer. So if it were a totally red picture, then I would scan the picture from top to bottom with the mouse, and the loudspeakers would say red. I placed the male voice on the left and the female voice on the right in order to get a kind of panorama effect from left to right. So if I move from left to right, I get the male voice going to the female. But if I stand at one point, I get a loop of just that part of the word red or blue, depending.
Where do you see all that going in terms of the works that cross domains? Is this your principal line of investigation at the moment?
Well, I've written a lot of music which is autonomous and doesn't
Very true.
Relate yeah. to anything, any language or any image or anything like that. And every piece of mine comes as a surprise to me. Certain pieces, of course, have been on the cards for years now, so I know all about them and I could describe them even though they're not written. But if you ask me, what are you planning next? Actually, always I need to finish the unfinished pieces. But if I were to say in which direction I expect to be going, I wouldn't know. I would be able to answer that more as a music theorist because I've been investigating aspects of tonality, harmonicity, and such things, and metricity. And there I know where I want to go, but that's again as a researcher rather than a composer.
Well, I remember specifically in one case where you seemed stymied by the fact that the next step in the piece involved pasting, I think, 40,000 small pieces of paper onto a display. But in how many like situations do you find yourself? That is, you're waiting on some technological breakthrough before you can finish the piece.
Oh, it's happened a number of times. Mm-hmm. That which you refer to is something that I also mentioned earlier, making a chart, an image, or a diagram which would reflect qualities of the music. And since I couldn't do it in 1976, because I've had to paste 70,000 pieces of paper to pre-drawn squares, mm-hmm. then I waited about 30 years, and then in 2001, I was able to do it with the new technology we had. I was able to program that. And there's an electronic piece of mine, Sinophony 2, which I made in 1972, which is really an installation. It should run for an infinite number of years, mm-hmm. or at least a few weeks. And I would love to program that someday. And now technology is fast enough for it to be generated in real time. But in those days, impossible. You mm-hmm. had to pre-compose it and then generate it on tape.
Have there been expositions of your work that equate to art exhibits? They're so visual in many respects that one can imagine an entire show of your work as visual work with auditory components.
Well, I have been asked to write music for exhibitions on the odd occasion, But this was music which didn't have anything to do with images, because after all, I was in somebody else's art mm-hmm. exhibition. Mm-hmm. And in my own case, I have given a series of lectures, or I should say a lecture tour, with one lecture called Musica Visualis, or Visual Music, which has shown these. So in other words, I talk and then I show the film. Because, as I say, the visual part of the work, except where I've actually taken, like Oscar Fischinger's film, mm-hmm. taken really wonderful visual artifacts. Mm-hmm. In all other cases, I don't regard the visuals as being so artistic and so high that it would warrant warrant a concert or an art exhibition. But I would simply say a lecture is good enough, and after a few words of introduction on my part, one can view the result.
Well, if it was good enough for Charles Darwin, I suppose it is still a good medium to get one's point across. But I have to ask you, what would you consider the perfect medium? I'm sure that you're aware that in this culture of America today, there's a lot of discussion about the concert and whether it is still relevant given the explosion of communications media that we have, and interactive media now. Is the concert still the best forum for the presentation of your work, as diverse as it is?
It depends on the work. If it's a tape piece, if it's a piece for a mechanical piano, then you would need a concert indeed. You would need an audience. I feel, in any case, some people feel CDs are enough, or DVDs, and you can send them out. But I feel a situation of sitting all together and watching something or hearing something, that's still very valid, that probably will not die out, because people always like to enjoy things in community. That's one thing. Another thing is performance of works like a difficult piano piece contain this element of risk. It has to be realized on stage in front of the audience. And if it's a particularly virtuosic piece, it can be extremely, so it could make the audience very tense in a positive way. Then again, there are these moments of extreme beauty that a pianist or a violinist might touch on, and it's coming out in real time. Now, that's really like listening to somebody speak or enunciate a poem in front of one. If that were just conserved, it loses a part of that charm. One can enjoy it, but hearing it unfold directly before one adds a lot to the experience.
So there's that element of walking the tightrope in a live concert. There's the element of the dimension that a live player might bring that was totally unforeseen, which we've all experienced, I think. The live performance has a dimension that even the composer never imagined could be there.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
But what about where we find ourselves right now on television? How would that suit you as a medium of expression for your own art?
Television itself. Mm-hmm. Well, in any case, I'm getting very, very interested more and more so in video. I would like to make a number of video films in the way that I've done up to now, but probably with higher demands placed on myself artistically. And some of these video films could be films in their own right. I actually did make a film which I think is a film in its own right. It's called Uccelli Ungheresi back in 1988. And everybody thought I was crazy making these very short little frames of a quarter second. But a quarter second is easy, or an eighth of a second, easily perceived. And one can easily see all the frames right through the movie and remember them. So I think I'll do much more of that, and I think television is a very viable medium for that.
I can't see why they thought you were crazy when Madison Avenue is doing that right and left, you know, with
Absolutely.
These short little...
Yes.
So you were simply ahead of your time, Clarence. That's all it was. My very first question to you was about, it involved my setting up the question to the effect that you were born in Calcutta. And you alluded to some works of yours earlier that... go back to the source roots of Indian music. I'm familiar with some of those, mm-hmm. some preludes and fugues, as a matter of fact. Tell us about the Ludus Regalis and why you would choose to adapt Johann Sebastian Bach's work, really, to the language of the music of India.
Well, it was like this. I'm not one of those who thinks Indian music is totally different to Western music and that they're really poles apart. I knew a lot of Europeans, a lot of Westerners in Calcutta who loved Indian music, who were studying Indian music, and they didn't know anything about Western music. At least they might have known a little bit of Mozart and Beethoven mm-hmm. by listening, but not by performance. I didn't know a single Western musician who became an Indian musician. They were always on the one side or the other. There was, for example, a sarod player whose name was John Barlow. He was born in Australia. We had no relatives at all. And we used to talk about music a lot. And one day he said to them, do you know how much Indian music and Western music have in common? And that's something they'd never thought about. I said, well, they're the same 12 notes. But apart from that, look at the harmonic schemes. And I began to point out certain rags where you have a tonic and a dominant. A rag is an Indian mode with more than just the notes. It's also the behavioral patterns, how you treat the notes. So I said, look at this one. Here you have tonic and dominant. You could almost say C and G in the same rag. And they said, well, yes, but then they couldn't hear so clearly as Europeans. So I decided for myself to write a prelude in one of the rags and show them that this would be totally Western music, but that they would recognize the rag embedded in there, mm-hmm. and that I would not violate the rag in any way. I did that, and I remember that a very famous singer came to visit me, an Indian singer, and I played him the prelude on the piano. He didn't say very much, but I heard from his students later, he was saying this in class, this Clarence Barlow has written this incredible piece where he plays rag kamod with three melodies all at the same time, because he wasn't used to listening contrapuntally. But having done that, I decided to take more rags, first of all to write a fugue, and then I took another 12 rags. First I took another 11 to make a set of 12, then I was commissioned to write a 13th, the fugue of which I wrote last year here in Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. And so all 13 have been now performed, and each one of them adheres to the rules of the rag, but is by no means a non-Western piece. They're entirely Western pieces, entirely Baroque, with a leaning towards the Renaissance, and a leaning towards, you might say, Reger, Hindemith.
I couldn't agree more. That's a perfect description. And having worked on some of them, you come away absolutely with the impression that this is Western, but at the same time, these qualities of each rag are coming through.
Yes, they
and
have
that
to.
That was your objective.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I wanted the rag to be recognizable, certainly, and to be heard as preserved. So the benchmark, was when I was sitting with an Indian musician in Berlin. And I asked him during the rehearsal, would you listen to these pieces and tell me what rags they're in? And he rattled off the names after a few seconds of each one of them. It was only number 8 that he had a problem with, and he took a little longer to recognize.
Were there any that were very recalcitrant to you as composer? That is, they were stubborn, they were kicking and screaming as you attempted to bring them into the Western
They lent themselves wonderfully. And the 12 that I chose, I happen to know rather well, but for number 13, I had to learn a new rag, which I did, and the piece is indeed in that rag.
Well, it certainly, they profit study, and I hope that people will pick them up and take them on, because they're a worthy addition to that repertory that you mentioned that goes Bach, Hindemith, Reger, and hopefully now Barlow. So will you continue to write music for absolutely standard instruments alongside those of your pieces that require quite complicated technical arrangements?
I don't see any reason why not. I mean, I wouldn't be able to project the future, but I don't see any reason to stop.
Now we can move to a whole different area, which is teaching, because, of course, your function here is to be the master teacher to UC Santa Barbara's composers, and I would think that many aspiring composers who might be watching us now would be curious about your views as to teaching and how a student might prepare for a career in this discipline today, which is so all over the place, particularly in America. Have you picked up on a sense yet, having only been here a year, have you picked up on how an American composer might profit from, say, more study of what's going on in Europe?
Well, I think one of the ways would be, of course, by inviting people from Europe or elsewhere. We have the entire world, we have Japan as well. Inviting people from these various places and from other parts of North America to come to the campus and talk about their work. I think talking about one's work is a very important thing. I myself do that because I believe that if I explain my own work to students, they should not emulate the work, but they may get ideas. They may be inspired to do certain things or even not. So that's one way, I think, of doing it. The other way, of course, is to point out, or at least another way, is to point out things in the world outside and say, go and look at that, go into the internet, check on that, go to the library. And a third way would be, of course, to look at the students' own works and to give them hints or to suggest improvements in certain places and ask questions as to why the works look the way they do. But I think more important than the last is actually the first, showing works that exist in the world.
And given what might be termed the self-absorption of American youth culture today, I find it very commendable, too, that this course of yours now ongoing sends the young composers out to see all of these other disciplines from which they might derive ideas. And it's easy to infer, then, that that's been the case with yourself, that you've gotten many, many ideas from things outside music.
Oh, absolutely. This whole quarter is dedicated to derivation of music from other sources. And these sources could be image, they could be language, they could be mathematics, and they could be sound recordings. And that's what I talk about because I've been doing this. I don't know whether I was inspired to think in this way by my teacher, Mauricio Cargill, because he was also a very prolific person who did all kinds of things. He also connected film and music and sound, and so image and sound. And I attended a couple of his courses. He did courses in Cologne. They were called the Cologne Courses of New Music in the late 60s and early 70s. I'm sure that was a great inspiration to me and opened my eyes and ears to all these possibilities. On the other hand, I do know that even before that, that I was interested in combining things. Mm-hmm. My first atonal piece, you might say, was not the first atonal piece, but I wrote a piece in 67, which is actually just for fun, but I took various melodies from The Sound of Music, which is one of the most kitschy pieces of music I know, and put them in different keys and played them at the same time in different tempi, and it sounds like an extremely complex work by Schoenberg. So things like that, I don't know what made me do it, but I did it, and that was in 1967.
So even American music theater has had a limited impact on your aesthetic.
American music theater?
Mm-hmm. Sound of Music.
Sound of Music, yes. Exactly, right.
Language is one of your favorite passions, I know. How many languages do you in fact speak?
Well, it depends on how well you mean. I get by pretty well with English and German. My Dutch and French are also reasonable enough for me to speak and to write emails. But I don't understand the news in French as well as I would like to, for example. And then carrying on, there are other languages which I could speak, the last of them being maybe just enough to ask directions and to understand the replies. And these, if you care to know what these are, they carry on with Cologne dialect, which is a language in its own right, and then Hindi, the major language of North India. And then it would go on to Portuguese, Bengali, restaurant Italian.
And how dangerous is it to assert that music is its own language, therefore it should not attempt to subjugate itself to written language?
Oh, I think that music is definitely a language in itself, but that this language is open to being combined with other languages. I mean, think of Schubert, who had no problem with that. So I definitely think music can be autonomous, it can speak for itself. I always tell my filmmaker friends, it's amazing how dependent they are on music, whereas we musicians don't need film, we can just make the music for itself. Mm-hmm. So, but I think music does lend itself, and one can do things with music in other dimensions as well.
Because as a young composer, one could not move in a Clarence Barlow direction without considerable study into mathematics. How far should they go into language, and how should they approach that study?
I think it would be fantastic. I'm not a linguist myself, although I love language, but I think it would be fantastic if a composer were to take the trouble to study linguistics, because there's lots there. I'm a hobby linguist in certain ways. I have certain books on the subject, and I refer to these books when I need them. I was even thinking once of using Chomsky's rules of generative grammar for music. I haven't done that. I did create, however, a language which is music. In other words, percussionists play, and what they're playing has a meaning, a semantic meaning. I translated Hamlet's soliloquy into this language, which I call progethal percussion, percussion with an I-A-N at the end. And I translated a few United Nations resolutions on Iraq and Palestine and Israel.
Now, how does this work? I'm very curious as to how this... Are you taking the consonant, the phonemes of the language?
No, not phonetically, no? Entirely semantically. I create a vocabulary based on percussion sounds, which don't sound anything like any language we speak.
No.
They are entirely drums and some metal and glass and things like that. And having created the vocabulary with the help of Roger's Thesaurus, I may say, I then create a grammar. Every measure of the language, of a piece in the language, is a word. And it will contain an article if necessary. It'll also contain information as to whether it's singular or plural. If it's a verb, it'll contain information as to whether it's transitive or intransitive, and so on. So I have to pass a human language first into its elements, into its grammatical elements. And then I actually do have a computer program which I wrote, which can convert my parsing into a score.
For the instruments?
For the instruments.
So is there dative, ablative, and genitive case for a bass drum?
No, I've done away with a lot of the cases. But I have included the genitive of verbs. For example, by opening the door would be doors openings with apostrophe S in both cases. Mm. So I put the genitive into both of these words, and you know you can also have whole chains of such things. So doors, openings, and carrying on. So that's one of the, I would say, things that I thought out. That's one of the things. And other things are... that's a bit difficult for me to recount at the moment. I'd have to be probably looking at my materials to be able to tell you that. And certainly it's a language with a complete set of grammatical rules.
I know that you are addicted to puns, and I enjoy that very much. Have you ever tried a musical pun?
Well, a musical pun would be something like a chord, like
taken two senses.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. C7, the B-flat can be regarded as an A-sharp, mm-hmm. and that would give it another meaning.
Which Beethoven did, really.
Yes, exactly.
But you've never been tempted to follow in his footsteps in that way?
Not so much. I've written at least titles which are puns.
Yes, indeed.
But the music itself, to make that an issue, no, I haven't. Not consciously, anyway.
I think we Americans feel so close to your aesthetic because you fit this mold of the inventor. Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense for how American that is? And that many Americans have invented great things in their garages and their workshops and so on, much as you've done, working largely without a lot of help. I mean, you've waited for technological development. You have collaborators in the software arena and so on. But it almost gives one the notion that it's still possible to do great things as an individual, as an inventor. Would you subscribe to that view?
I would say it helps to be in a group of people, among a group of people who are all striving for similar things, and you feel strengthened by that. That was my feeling, for example, in Cologne in the year 68 to 73, when I had a whole lot of wonderful composers around me, and we formed a group, and we worked for the same things. But then again, in spite of all of that, in that very group, I was the only one who got into computer music. And why? Because I had an idea for a piece which was totally spontaneous. I imagined these sounds on the cello. And the way I imagined these sounds was there was a certain process, a certain concept behind that. And I had to hear the music in my head in order to actually formulate the concept. And then I realized that this was actually a mathematical concept. I didn't realize it first. And having found the formulas for the mathematical concept, I started to try and realize the piece using a calculator that they used to use in shops, you know, with all kinds of buttons at the top, and you press enter, and then you get a bell sound, and a figure would appear. I bought one of those because pocket calculators didn't exist in 1970. But I found that this was going to take me months and months and months for just a few minutes of music. Mm-hmm. So that's where the idea came to me one morning that a computer could probably solve the problem. And I had no idea about the music of Xenakis and others, and that they were doing using computers for similar reasons. It's very, very simply, hey, I think I can solve this problem with a computer. And that's how I started to learn computer programming. So these things can strike one. It's a matter of inspiration. I don't know where it comes from, mm-hmm. But I was inspired to start using computers, and I haven't looked back since.
But that too fits the profile of the inventor. That is, that they're looking for a new way, a new material, a new expedient.
Or one has a problem and looks for a way to solve it. For example, I wouldn't be looking for tools for anything if I didn't have something I wanted to make. So if I was going to work with wood, and I knew I'm working with this wood, then I would need a saw, maybe, and then I'd look for it. But the tool doesn't come first. It's always the object, it's always the music, or if I'm working in the visual field, it's always the visual. If I'm working in the linguistic, in the language field, it will be that. I've written a number of articles and texts, and I see how my brain works trying to formulate sentences, and I just let it go and let it work the way it does. So I think the tools that one uses are always, it's nice if they're at hand. If not, you have to make them.
Mm-hmm. And that is the other trait of the inventor, which is patience. You know, making a tool, that's a huge undertaking for many people. They're not unwilling to do it. What would you have to say on the subject of patience and the arts?
Well, I think I'm a very patient person, and certain things have taken me years. For example, my computer program, Autobusk, took me 14 years. And a book that I edited, the ratio book, on a symposium held in The Hague, took me 9 years to edit. All of these things, because of course I was busy teaching and doing other things at the same time. You can't spend all your time, unfortunately, doing research and composition and software development. So I have waited all those years. I think the longest I waited was to finish my second piano concerto, 35 years, and then I finished it. And I'm a very tenacious person, so I will definitely finish things I intend to finish unless something serious gets in the way. But that is, I think, important. Another thing is also, I know lots of software developers who are quite happy to use given tools, and they will develop their entire software based on some toolkit here and there. For some reason, if a toolkit doesn't please me aesthetically, and that's where the aesthetic comes into computer programming, that I will develop my own tools there too and lose maybe a lot of time, they would say. But I'm satisfied at the end. And I've taken all that time, been very patient, and there it is. And they said, oh, but you could have done it with that tool. I said, no, but I don't like the look of that tool.
So have you had experiences then where younger composers or video artists come to you and say, thank you for your pioneering work in that area or persisting in that particular very difficult pathway to a given solution?
Fortunately, growing older brings you experiences like that. I think they started already in the end of the 80s when people came to me for advice, and I said, well, your problem here looks very, very logical and mathematical. Why don't you learn computer programming? So he said, well, what should I do? I said, well, buy yourself an Atari computer and learn to program in C. And he did, and he's become a very, very capable programmer now. He's a musician. He's a professor of trombone in Cologne. But he does his own software. And he still thanks me for that.
How would you advise someone who might be watching this now and curious enough at this point to come to a concert and hear some of your work? Is it necessary that they prepare in any sense?
I wouldn't think so. I wouldn't know what to prepare them for. But if, on the other hand, they ask me, as a new student of ours who's coming very soon, he's been admitted, he asked me, what should I do in the meantime? I said, well, read books on aesthetics, books on acoustics, and learn to program, because you can develop your own tools that way. Because I find that people who use, and I'm not repeating myself when I say, who use tools for composition that exist, they tend to sound like other people using the same tools. So if you program in a programming language, you can be much freer. So that was the advice I gave the student.
You mentioned aesthetics, and I know that you value the teaching of that discipline very highly, but where do we look for our guidelines, our teachers of aesthetics, when there's so much cachet in American society on being the first to do something, the inventor of something? Where do you go for models as a young composer, and how do you learn aesthetics as a young composer?
Well, you're touching on the subject of originality now.
Yes.
And that's the virus which has kind of bitten us or infected us ever since at least the second Viennese School or the Darmstadt School of the 50s.
And Stravinsky.
Yes, exactly, Stravinsky as well. Of course, Beethoven is a model of originality, and so is Perotin, going back all the way to 1200. But I would say that that is descriptively so, and that could not be made into a prescription. Anyone told you must be original would be given the wrong advice. Mm-hmm. The person must learn how to hold his own, do his own thing, and I would say not be original, but write good music. Now, very often a composer imitates other composers. He might be writing good music, but it'll never be as good as the original. That's why I say, try not to supply something which we have. If you're able to give us something which I was waiting for, then I'm the most satisfied person, no matter what style that might be in. But usually it'll tend to be in a new style. But the sheer cultivation and looking for new styles, when students tell me, I would love to develop my own personal style, then I answer and say, well, write good music first.
But isn't it necessary to supply something that we don't have but don't know that we're looking for? That is, if it's something that the consumer already has a firm handle on and a complete grasp of, that seems almost less valuable, doesn't it, than a complete welcome surprise.
But of course, that depends entirely on how open one is to inspiration, how creative the mind is, and how experienced one is in finding things. Now, for example, as a cook, you would be tasting something you're cooking, and you say, I think this is lacking this, this, and that, or I need a little bit more of that, maybe a tiny bit more of this. So you use your imagination to know what you need to add. In the same way, a composer looking to solve a piece, to realize a piece, will be subjected to two things. One thing will be inspiration, because the sheer openness, the sheer waiting for this piece to develop and in the mind would open several channels. But secondly, the composer must also be critical and must also say, what's wrong about this piece? Something is wrong, and I've got to find out what it is and how to remedy that. And I would say these two bits of advice could be given. But the idea of the personal style, if a composer is really creative, it's very likely that the composer will be very original, but he can't set out to be so. I'm sure Beethoven never sat down and said, I want to be original. He just was.
But I was thinking of Boccherini, whom I enjoy very much as a composer, and yet we wouldn't really call him a first original.
Right. There are composers like that, too. And, for example, my beloved Rachmaninoff would be another case in point.
But you don't sound as though you're one of those that thinks the teaching of composition is simply an impossible prospect. I mean, I've had teachers of composition tell me that, strangely enough.
Now, you cannot teach composition in that sense, but you can inspire, and you can bring together information.
And criticize, perhaps.
And criticize, exactly. Mm-hmm. Just about a week ago, I was invited to the University of Florida and did two master classes there. Had four students at each master class. Each showed me scores, played tapes. And it was very interesting. I tried to involve all of us in discussion. And for each piece, there was something to be said about what was good about it, but what it still needed. So I think if one has the experience, as a cook, you wouldn't know what to add if you were just setting out to cook and being the first dish you'd ever made. But if you've got the experience over the years, then you know what to add. In the same way, I probably know more than the students who are sitting there in the master classes, or I could pick on these things maybe quicker, but or I might have touched on something which made one of them or two of them think of something else, which was exactly what we needed.
So what kind of Epicurean ingredients would you be projecting to add here into our program at UC Santa Barbara?
Oh, I certainly want us to be open to everything, and I want the student body, the composers, to form a wonderful group to work together. For that, we need a certain critical mass. We can't just admit, say, two students a year. That doesn't make a community.
A supportive community.
A supportive community. Mm-hmm. You need a composer's community here where the composers inspire each other together and not just work on their own to get their credits. It would be absolutely wonderful if you see that a student might mention on occasion, well, I was inspired by something he said, another student. That would be excellent.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll be looking for the very exciting new recipes that you'll be concocting for us here at UC Santa Barbara. Some very exciting work happening in April 2007 featuring your work as part of the Primavera Festival this year. I know you're planning also on bringing first-rate guests beginning next academic year also.
But also in Primavera.
Yes, people. As soon as that.
Yes, I mean, we have a clarinetist, we have a guitarist, for example.
Both renowned for performing your work in Europe.
No, Gareth Davis, not yet. But he's a very good clarinetist, and I know him from Europe. And I also know, of course, Seth Josel, the guitarist, who's excellent.
So we've been talking with Clarence Barlow, the new Corwin Chair of Composition here at UC Santa Barbara. And thank you very much. I'm Jeremy Halladina.